Chapter 2. Migration and Culture. Migrations have transferred cultures across vast distances and thereby transformed whole regions of the planet as new skills, new organizational patterns, new work habits, new savings propensities, new attitudes toward education and toward life all have had their impact on the environments to which people moved. Cultures may be shaped by the environments in which they have evolved, but they are also capable of reshaping other environments to which they are transferred. Human migrations take many forms. Whole peoples have moved together across whole continents, as with Genghis Khan's conquering hordes sweeping across Asia and deep into Europe. By contrast, Jews and Chinese have been expelled en masse from a number of countries at various periods of history, and millions of Africans were transported in bondage to the Western Hemisphere and to the Middle East. Around the world, vast numbers of refugees have fled the disasters of nature and of man. In addition to specific cultural differences between particular racial and ethnic groups who migrate, there are more generic differences between refugees and conquerors, or between emigrants who assimilate into the surrounding society and those who remain encapsulated in their own enclaves within the recipient societies. These various kinds of cultural differences and their consequences will be explored in turn, as will the larger question of the evolution of a modern culture shared to a degree by many peoples and cultures around the world. The impact of immigration. The voluntary emigration of individuals and families has been the largest source of international movements of people in recent centuries. Even a small country like Lebanon has sent hundreds of thousands of emigrants abroad in the course of a century, and 2.5 million Muslims emigrated from the Russian Empire to the Ottoman Empire in the last half of the 19th century. However, Europe, as the major conquering force of this era, has supplied most of the world's emigrants. The United States has been the largest recipient of European emigrants and the most dramatic example of the economic and cultural changes they wrought. Of the 70 million people who emigrated from Europe over the past few centuries, nearly 50 million went to the United States, and 35 million of these arrived in just one century, from 1830 to 1930. However, other transplanted European societies, such as Australia, Argentina, Canada, or Brazil, were also transformed and developed not simply by the respective conquering peoples, but also, and in some cases primarily, by peoples from other parts of Europe. These have included not only immigrant settlers, but also sojourning foreigners who have played a major role in the economic development of Latin America, for example. Non-European emigrants have also played a major role in the modernization of many societies, including societies largely under the political control of European colonial powers. Emigrants from the Indian subcontinent, for example, created both retail and wholesale trade, as well as industries and international trade across vast regions of East Africa, where the rupee was at one time the standard currency. Chinese emigrants, often beginning as coolie laborers, likewise ended up as entrepreneurs, who transformed the economic and social landscape of many countries in Southeast Asia. Whether in East Africa or Southeast Asia, the transformation of whole economies by immigrants was often also an economic transformation of the immigrants themselves, if not from poverty to riches, at least to a modest prosperity by the standards of the times and places. Similar stories could be told of the Lebanese in West Africa, or the Japanese in southern Brazil or western Canada, where they were a major part of the pioneering phase of economic development. Such economic and social transformations did not end with the pioneering eras in these countries. Successive waves of immigrants from different sources often added new and different skills, attitudes, and resources, sometimes with dramatic effect. Such transformations reflect substantial cultural differences between the existing population and the newcomers. For example, although the Portuguese inhabited and ruled Brazil for hundreds of years, they did little to develop a modern economy there before the arrival of other European immigrants. In early 19th century Brazil, even such basic items as doors, flour, salt, sugar, furniture, and books were imported. German, Italian, and other immigrants created much of the industry of the country, beginning in the late 19th century, and their descendants continued dominant in these industries even in the middle of the 20th century. During the period from the late 19th century until the end of World War II, importers in São Paulo were almost invariably immigrants. This was not due to a lack of wealthy Portuguese Brazilians, but those members of the Brazilian plantation-owning elite families who pursued non-agricultural careers tended to go into the professions, rather than into commerce or industry. As late as 1913, only two Brazilian-owned firms ranked among the top 15 exporters in the port city of Santos. Argentina, like Brazil, was profoundly changed by the changing composition of its people, brought on by immigration that was massive relative to its existing population size. As of 1914, immigrants constituted 30% of the total Argentine population, about twice as high as the highest proportions ever reached in the United States during the peak of its mass immigration era. The effect of the immigrants on the Argentine economy was far more than demographic, however. Little economic activity flourished in Argentina, except for cattle raising, before the era of large-scale immigration began. Both industry and agriculture in Argentina were created by immigrants. In 1873, Germans in Buenos Aires opened 43 import-export businesses, 45 retail establishments, and about 100 artisan craft shops. Italians, who have been the most numerous among Argentina's immigrants, in some years more than half, have been credited with turning the Argentine Pampa into productive agricultural land, both as farmers and as farm laborers. The Italians' economic role was also large in the city, where their skills, muscle, and savings were major factors in the development of many trades. As of 1895, foreigners constituted about 3/5 of Argentina's industrial workers and about 4/5 of the owners of industrial enterprises. As late as the 1920s, it was said of Argentina that if you want a shoe sold, a lock or kettle mended, a bookcase made, a book bound or a pamphlet printed, a roll of film developed or a camera repaired, you will go to an immigrant or the son of an immigrant. In the middle of the 20th century, more than 3/4 of all Argentine generals, admirals, and bishops over a 25-year period were either immigrants or mostly the sons of immigrants. In Mexico, in the early 20th century, Yucatan went from being one of the poorest provinces in the country to being one of its most prosperous as a result of industrial development led by immigrants, who constituted less than 1% of the province's population. In Peru, most of the manufacturing firms not controlled by foreigners were controlled by immigrant families. In Chile, German immigrant farmers turned a virtually barren wilderness into one of the agricultural showplaces of South America, and Germans also established such industrial enterprises as tanneries, sawmills, soap factories, flour mills, distilleries, shoe factories, and shipyards. Immigrants played such a large role in the industrialization of Chile that they and their children still owned 3/4 of the industrial enterprises in Santiago in the second half of the 20th century. Seldom were these immigrants simply prosperous foreigners who brought their wealth with them. On the contrary, most of those who became middle class in Argentina were working class in origin. The pioneering German farmers in Brazil and Paraguay were typically of peasant origins and faced harrowing experiences in their early years when it was a struggle merely to survive. Italian land laborers were initially poverty-stricken and brutally treated. To an even greater degree, so were the Chinese and Japanese indentured laborers brought into Peru, though their descendants went on to become prominent among Peruvian retail store owners. What all those groups brought was not wealth, but the ability to create wealth, whether on a modest scale or a grand scale, whether through specific skills or just hard work. They did not share the Spanish and Portuguese settlers' disdain for manual labor, or for commerce and industry, or for thrift. The work of European, largely non-Iberian immigrants in developing Latin America was supplemented by the economic activities of foreign businessmen who did not necessarily settle permanently in the countries where they established businesses, but who nevertheless played a major role in the various economies of the region. Aliens tended to dominate commerce in general, and international trading firms in particular. In Recife, one of Brazil's leading ports in the 19th century, only 22 out of 65 import-export merchants were Brazilians in 1841, and only 23 out of 77 in 1848. Of 27 export firms that shipped virtually all of the coffee from the port of Santos in 1885 through 1886, only 4 had Portuguese surnames. In Rio de Janeiro, not quite 1/3 of the members of the Associação Comercial from 1844 to 1902 were native Brazilians. Such predominance of foreigners among international traders was common throughout Latin America in the 19th century. In Valparaiso and Santiago, Foreigners outnumbered Chileans in the import-export business by nearly 2-to-1 and owned 4 times as many firms. Foreigners also owned 4 times as many large-scale international trade, wholesale, and retail firms as the Mexicans did in Mexico City. In Montevideo, foreign importers outnumbered Uruguayans by 7-to-1. In Buenos Aires in 1888, less than 10% of all import-export, wholesale, and retail firms were Argentine-owned. For the country as a whole, 81% of all industry was foreign-owned in 1895, and 66% as late as 1914. Whether this decline in foreign dominance represented a rise of an Argentine entrepreneurial class or the naturalization of foreigners is not clear. Still, in 1914, foreigners owned, in addition to 2/3 of Argentine industry, nearly 3/4 of Argentine commerce. Nor was this pattern unique to Argentina or to these particular economic sectors. British capital, skills, and entrepreneurship played major roles in developing railroads and public utilities in Latin America. Lima, Peru was unusual among Latin American capitals because its municipal utilities were built without significant British investment. Where Latin American businesses managed to succeed in competition with foreigners, this commercial success often lasted only one generation, as successful Latin American businessmen had their sons educated for the professions. Partly, this reflected a cultural preference for gentlemanly occupations, like land ownership, the professions, or a government career. Partly, too, it reflected Spanish inheritance laws, which would prevent a business from being passed on wholly to one son. Given that a business's viability with divided leadership was economically problematical, its prospects in the second generation might often be more precarious than in the first generation. The stunning impact of immigrants in transforming whole economies was not a pattern peculiar to Latin America, nor to European immigrants. In various other parts of the world, modern economic development was largely the work of immigrants or foreign investors, with the indigenous population playing little or no role in the modernization process. In colonial Malaya, for example, Chinese immigrants provided much of the labor that developed that country's giant tin industry, and immigrants from India manned the rubber plantations, both financed largely by European and American capital. Similar patterns of European capital and non-European immigrant labor combining to create economic development could be found from Fiji in the South Pacific to countries on the east coast of Africa and in the Middle East. Yet, in these and other countries, the earlier or indigenous population has almost invariably come to resent those foreigners, whether sojourners or immigrants, who raised the economic level of their country. In a later period especially, after the actual origins of particular economic activities have faded into the mists of time, foreign groups have often been denounced for having seized control of the nation's industries and exploited its people. It is as if businesses and wealth came into existence somehow, and foreigners happened to take possession of them. The great era of European emigration and the establishing of European offshoot societies in the Western Hemisphere, Australia and New Zealand, has been succeeded by a large-scale emigration from less developed nations, especially in the 20th century. By the 1980s, an estimated 50 to 55 million people were living outside the lands of their birth, about 60% of these being from less developed countries. Nor were all of these migrants from the Third World simply unskilled laborers. India alone had more than 250,000 physicians, scientists, engineers, managers, administrators, and people in similar high-level occupations living in other countries around the world in the late 20th century. Not all emigrations ended with the emigrants settling permanently. Whether economically successful or not, many emigrants re-emigrated to yet another country, and sometimes to a third or fourth. Historically, the Jews have wandered from country to country, often in search of nothing more than a respite from persecution. Most of the Germans who immigrated into Canada in the late 19th century came not from Germany, but from Russia, where they had lived for generations, before conditions became intolerable. Some of these Germans who were Mennonites migrated again from Canada to Mexico, and some of these migrated yet again from Mexico to Honduras. Just over half the men who immigrated to Australia from the Greek mainland during the 1920s had lived in some other country before reaching Australia. In the 20th century, most of the Japanese immigrants to Bolivia came not from Japan, but from Peru. The story of emigration is also a story of re-emigration. Immigrants are not always minorities in the labor force. During the 1980s, there were countries in the Middle East where foreign workers made up about half the total labor force, Saudi Arabia, Libya, and Bahrain, and others where foreign workers constituted about four-fifths or more of the total labor force, Kuwait, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Much of this labor came from Asia. An estimated 2.5 million migrant workers from Asia were in the Middle East in the 1980s. These Asian workers typically earned several times what they made at home. They were usually young married men whose wives and children remained behind in their home country. Their annual remittances from the Middle East totaled $7 billion annually in 1980. Nor was this predominance of foreign workers in the labor force unique to the Middle East. In Fiji and Guyana, immigrants from India and their descendants came to outnumber the Fijians and the Afro-Americans, respectively, and in Mauritius, the Indians eventually constituted more than two-thirds of the total population. Cultures that migrate may or may not diffuse into the surrounding society. In Brazil, the zest for entrepreneurship and industrialization brought by immigrants eventually affected some of the offspring of the traditional planter elite who were trained at the São Paulo Polytechnical School. However, there is little evidence of a diffusion of the transplanted culture of immigrants in Malaysia, Fiji, or the Middle East. Sometimes, perhaps because of sheer size differences between the immigrant and indigenous populations, the opposite happens. Immigrants absorb the dominant culture around them. But the extent to which this happens, and the pace at which it happens, both vary greatly with the particular group and with the kind of societies to which they have migrated. Germans in Russia remained almost totally resistant to Russian culture for more than a century, re-immigrating in the late 19th century with virtually the same culture with which their ancestors had entered the country under Catherine the Great. Emigrants have often been described in national terms as Lebanese, Filipinos, or Yugoslavs, but they may think and act together in much different and usually smaller categories. Many of the immigrants in Southeast Asia have appeared to their host societies as simply Chinese, but they settled separately as Cantonese, Fukienese, Hailams, etc., practiced different occupations, and often fought each other. Lebanese emigrants likewise often lived separately and antagonistically to one another in foreign lands, recreating the animosities between various factions which have divided Lebanon itself. Among other groups as well, it has been common for small geographical concentrations of people from the same place in the country of origin to settle together in small geographical concentrations in the country of destination. Immigrants do not settle at random in a new country. Towns and villages only a few miles apart in Albania, Italy, Greece, or Yugoslavia, for example, have sent their emigrants to very different parts of Australia, where they engaged in very different occupations. Nor is this pattern peculiar to Australia. About 2,000 people from one Macedonian village lived in Toronto at one time, while only 500 people remained in that village back in Macedonia. Provincial and even village concentrations of Italians have remained together in the same neighborhoods in Buenos Aires, Toronto, and New York. Similarly, localized origins and destinations have been found among Swedish immigrants in South Dakota farming communities and among Lebanese immigrants in a number of countries. These clusterings of familiar people in a new country reflect the high costs and high risks of emigration in human as well as in economic terms, and represent attempts to soften their impact. By following in the footsteps of a member of the family, or someone else from the same community, emigrants are not as lost, isolated, or devastated by unexpected events as if they had settled alone at random in a new country. This was particularly important when many emigrants had little money, education, or conception of life beyond their own traditional communities. The national labels that others put on these community-centered people sometimes had no relationship to their conceptions of themselves or to the way they formed social ties in their new countries. Many emigrants from villages in Italy only discovered after reaching the Western Hemisphere that they were Italians. Emigrants from Yugoslavia set up Serbian or Croatian organizations in Australia far more often than they set up Yugoslavian organizations. Just as national labels may implicitly overstate the social cohesion of the groups under those labels, so may these national labels obscure the international ties among some groups whose cohesion extends across national borders. One of the reasons for the prominence of Jews in international trade, in various countries and various periods of history, has been their ties to other Jewish international traders in other countries. Similarly, Lebanese emigrants to a number of countries could enter an international network of Lebanese textile traders, centered in Manchester, England, even though they might not be able to associate with other factions of Lebanese immigrants in the same country. More generally, the labels put on any group by observers and analysts need not coincide with the lines of social cohesion or cultural loyalty respected by those people themselves. The ratio of male to female immigrants can have a profound effect on the survival of the cultures which the immigrants bring with them. A lopsidedly male immigrant population, often characteristic of early or exploratory immigration, may lead to much intermarriage and a subsequent dilution or extinction of the particular immigrant culture. But where whole families immigrate together, or where the sexes are sufficiently balanced to permit new families to be formed within the immigrant group, the group itself can retain its cultural cohesion longer. Both patterns may occur with the same group of immigrants in the same country, where sex ratios vary substantially by region. German immigrants who settled together as families in South Australia's Barossa Valley, for example, recreated German communities that remained solidly German in language and culture for generations, while German men who settled in Australia as individuals in Victoria and New South Wales were relatively quickly absorbed into the Australian population. The male-female ratio has varied enormously among immigrant groups, as well as within the same group over time. Spanish immigration to the Western Hemisphere was about 95% male at the beginning of the 16th century and declined to about 65% male by the end of that century. Japanese, Italian, or Chinese immigration has often consisted of more than 10 times as many men as women, while the Irish famine emigration to the United States was roughly sex-balanced, as refugee migrations tend to be, and in some years the Irish women outnumbered the men. Even among immigrant groups which are predominantly male in the early exploratory phases, it is not uncommon for more women than men to immigrate in later years, after the group has decided to settle permanently and form families. This has happened among Japanese, Italian, and Chinese immigrants in various times and places. Emigration is not always over long distances, nor always intended to be permanent. A number of groups have developed a pattern of sojourning some years abroad in order to make and save enough money to return home in prosperity. Land-hungry peoples, such as Italians or Poles, have historically followed such patterns in order to return home and become landowners. More commercial people, such as the overseas Chinese, have also followed a similar pattern of living abroad during youth and returning home in more mature years, at least until China became communist in 1949. Some temporary migrations have been seasonal, especially among agricultural workers, and particularly after the rise of the steamship sharply reduced the costs of overseas travel. Sojourners have often played major economic roles, not only in the societies to which they went, but also in the societies from which they came. The impact of the sojourning overseas Chinese on the economies of Southeast Asia is perhaps the most dramatic example, but British engineers and technicians, in smaller numbers, have had similarly dramatic impacts on countries where they introduced the technology of the industrial age, including Russia, Japan, Germany, Argentina, and the United States in the 19th century. Conversely, some sojourners have traveled from less developed countries to more industrialized nations, expressly for the purpose of acquiring knowledge to bring back to their homelands. Japanese, Germans, Americans, Russians, and others made such sojourns to 18th and 19th century Britain to acquire the latest technology there. In the late 20th century, so many foreigners have traveled to the United States for advanced training in science and technology that more than half of all mathematics and engineering PhDs awarded by American universities went to people who were not American citizens. While much immigration has been across oceans or between continents, there has also been much regional migration within South America, Europe, or Africa. It has been estimated that 80 to 90% of these migrations in South America are illegal, so accurate statistics are highly unlikely to be found. There are estimates of tens of thousands of Salvadorans having migrated, temporarily or permanently, to Honduras, and of as many as 100,000 Brazilians living in Paraguay in the late 20th century. By and large, migrations in Latin America have apparently been from the poorer to the more prosperous nations, notably to Argentina and Venezuela. Similarly, in Europe, guest workers have come typically from the poorer countries of the continent and beyond. Africa has also known large-scale migrations, as well as expulsions and mass refugee flight. The 50,000 Indians and Pakistanis suddenly expelled from Uganda in 1972, and a similar number of Ghanaians expelled from the Ivory Coast in 1983, were especially dramatic examples that captured world attention. But vast numbers of Europeans and Indians have been gradually forced out of other African countries and have fled in a steady stream over the years, especially since independence spread through Africa during the 1960s. The positive contributions of immigrants need not obscure their negative impacts on the societies receiving them. This is especially important in an era when cultural relativism creates taboos against discussing any unfavorable aspect of any group or culture. Yet standards of sanitation, incidences of crime and violence, proneness to become a charge upon the state, and many other social characteristics vary as much from one immigrant group to another as they do among other groups of human beings. In a given country at a given time, there may be similarly important differences between the current immigrants as a group and the people of the host society. When cholera swept through Irish immigrant neighborhoods in 19th century Boston and Philadelphia, or spread among Italian immigrants in 19th century London, that was not simply a matter of perceptions or stereotypes by the society around them. Neither were the corruption and violence of the criminal tongs among the immigrant Chinese populations in various Southeast Asian countries over a period of centuries, nor the Hong Kong immigrant organized crime ring in the San Francisco Bay Area in the late 20th century. The negative impacts of immigrants do not end with behavior that is clearly harmful in and of itself. The nature of their interactions with the existing populations of a country can be affected by biological, linguistic, religious, and other characteristics which enable some immigrant groups to fit in more readily than others. Indeed, some immigrant groups desire to fit in more so than others, and politically organized programs in some countries promote subsidized retention of foreign cultures, despite complaints of balkanization. Immigrants from Britain have tended to blend in more readily in the United States than have immigrants of a different color from Asia or the Caribbean. However, Asians or Hispanics have tended to become culturally assimilated over time, and eventually have had substantial rates of intermarriage by the third generation in the United States, while Germans who settled in 18th century Russia were far less assimilated a century later, and intermarriage remained very rare despite a greater physical similarity between Germans and Russians than between Chinese and white Americans, for example. Koreans in Japan have likewise remained a very separate social group, notwithstanding similarities with the Japanese population in skin color, hair texture, and the like. What matters is not how similar the groups may seem to outsiders, but how different they seem to each other. At various times and places, differences in religion have been more important than differences in color or language, but at other times and places, the order has been the reverse. There is no universally paramount criterion of difference, nor any given objective measure of dissimilarity. Yet, however subjective some group differences may be, their social costs are quite real and may be quite large. These costs may be paid economically, or in a reduced quality of life, or in bloodshed. In addition to real costs entailed by immigrants, there are often also false charges that they are a burden to the native-born population, in situations where they are not. However, sometimes there are hidden costs which may be different from what is charged, but significant nonetheless. A common charge against immigrants, for example, is that they take jobs from native-born workers. But there is no fixed number of jobs from which those going to immigrants can be subtracted. More producers coming into an economy mean more output and more demand, which in turn creates more jobs. It is an empirical question whether the additional jobs created as a result of the immigrants' economic activities equals or exceeds the number of jobs the immigrants themselves take. It is by no means out of the question that native workers may have more jobs available after immigrants arrive. Studies of the large influx of Mexican immigrants into Southern California, for example, showed no adverse impact on either the unemployment rate or the labor force participation rate of blacks in that region, who might be competing for similar jobs. In fact, job trends for blacks were more favorable in this area, heavily impacted by Mexican immigrants, than in the nation at large. But while there has apparently been an increase in the total number of jobs, there has been a correspondingly lower pay scale, as the large influx of immigrants has lessened the need for employers to raise wages in order to attract sufficient workers. The economic consequences of immigration on the native population in the host country are much more complicated than the job displacement theory suggests. It is also more complicated than the defenders of immigrants usually admit when they say that immigrants take jobs that the natives would not accept anyway. Where there are welfare state benefits available to low-income citizens, this means that the wage and salary level needed to attract these citizens into the labor market is higher than otherwise. Given this situation, it may well be true that immigrants take jobs that natives reject at existing low wage levels, but this does not mean that those jobs would have been unfilled in the absence of immigration. Because there are very few occupations that can be dispensed with entirely, many jobs would have been filled with natives at higher wage rates, even if the total number of jobs were less than when abundant supplies of immigrants are available. It is a common pattern in welfare states to have such jobs as hotel maids or hospital orderlies held by immigrants from poorer countries, but this does not mean that there would be no maids or orderlies if there were no immigrants. While immigrants bring demonstrable benefits to an economy, their hidden costs include the cost to the taxpayers of maintaining more native-born workers in idleness, whether as a permanent way of life or as a more lengthy average period of unemployment between jobs, as the natives search longer for work that pays sufficiently more than they receive from unemployment compensation or other welfare state benefits. The more numerous and more remunerative the welfare state benefits, the higher the cost to the taxpayers of having a large-scale immigration of working-class immigrants. Even if the immigrants themselves do not resort to the welfare state enough to offset their own tax contributions, and studies in Canada, Australia, and the United States suggest that immigrants pay more into the public treasury than they take out, at least in these particular countries, their indirect effects in keeping more natives idle longer can still impose burdens on the taxpayers. Whether these additional burdens exceed the additional taxes paid by the immigrants themselves is an empirical question in each country. However, it may be worth noting that countries with large and wide-ranging welfare state benefits, such as New Zealand, are especially resistant to large-scale immigration, even when the existing population is small, both absolutely and relative to the country's land and natural resources. Authorities in Denmark have cracked down on refugees seeking asylum on grounds that they are in fact seeking to milk the welfare state there. Germany, which has had both open borders and generous welfare state benefits available to new immigrants, has also had some of the most bitter and violent anti-foreigner activities of any country in the world. On purely economic grounds, it should not be surprising that immigrants are less in demand now that they are much more costly to the countries receiving them. In the era before the full flowering of the welfare state, immigration was much freer in many parts of the world, and a number of countries in the Western Hemisphere actually subsidized immigration. The social consequences of immigration are even harder to estimate than their economic consequences. An influx of immigrant children into the schools may make it harder for young native-born children to learn to speak the native language of the country properly. Moreover, dogmatic attitudes among educators may discourage native parents from complaining for fear of being labeled racist or the like. Both crime rates and rates of childbearing may be higher among immigrants, simply because immigrants tend to be young adults, and young adults tend to commit more than their share of the crimes in all groups, as well as being more likely to produce children. Correcting the data for age differences between the immigrants and the native population may reveal that the immigrants are no more likely than natives of the same age to have children or to commit crimes, but these statistical corrections are socially meaningless to those who find their children's education compromised by an influx of students who do not speak the language or who find themselves increasingly victimized by crime. Often, it is not only the native-born population, but even earlier waves of the same immigrant group who resent the newcomers, as, for example, acculturated Mexican Americans often resent the new immigrants from Mexico. Whether for social or for economic reasons, a majority of the people polled in Belgium, Britain, France, Germany, and Italy in 1991 declared that there were too many immigrants living in their countries. Moreover, such feelings have led to political demands for restricting immigration in a number of European countries, as well as in the United States and Australia, while Japan avoids the whole problem by keeping immigrants out. How many of the objections to immigrants represent personal experience or valid inferences about the costs imposed on the society by immigration, and how many objections represent misunderstandings of the situation or intergroup prejudices, is a perplexing question. However, what is quite clear is that immigration often generates internal conflict, and that such conflict is itself a serious cost, regardless of whether it is or is not based on true and legitimate concerns. Organized political efforts to promote retention of foreign languages and cultures add to the social cost of admitting immigrants, even when in fact the immigrants themselves are rapidly assimilating, because that assimilation may be far much less widely known than the strident separatist demands of group advocates with their own agendas. Needless intergroup friction over illusory issues has very real costs to the whole society. The chief focus here is not on such current immigration policy issues. Rather, the larger and longer-run question concerns the economic and social effects of enduring group cultures, as compared to the effects of more immediate surroundings and more immediate government policies, or the political activities designed to influence such policies. In short, with immigrants, as with conquered peoples or middleman minorities, the question is the degree to which internal cultural patterns persist and shape the economic and social fate of a people. There are many kinds of immigrants, and these differ generically from one another in addition to the particular cultural differences they have as racial or ethnic groups. Refugees, for example, differ generically from sojourners in that the former tend to be relatively evenly balanced between the sexes, while the latter are often predominantly male, especially during the earlier or exploratory phases of migration to a new country. People who are fleeing disasters or the impending threat of disasters tend to flee without regard to sex and without the selectivity of other kinds of migration. By contrast, those who migrate to accomplish some purpose abroad and then return home are likely to be a selective sample of the home population and are more likely to be men hoping to establish themselves financially and return to form a family or be reunited with a family that was waiting and may now hope for a better life with the return of the father. Other kinds of immigrants also differ generically in other ways. Two such generic groups of immigrants are middleman minorities and encapsulated minorities. Middleman minorities. In addition to sharing various economic functions and arousing similar political hostilities, middleman minorities have also tended to exhibit similarities in certain social traits, despite their great differences from each other in specific cultural features such as religion, food, dress, and language. The overseas Chinese and the Jews of the diaspora are obviously of different races and have different religions, food, and language. Yet they, as well as Lebanese, Armenians, and Gujaratis and Chettiars from India, among others, have been noted for such patterns as working long hours, thrift, peacefulness, sometimes equated with cowardice, commercial reliability, and clannishness. Much of this pattern simply goes with the economic role they play. Because small retail businesses are much more easily set up than giant industrial enterprises, the pressure of numerous competitors virtually ensures that profits cannot come easily to middleman minorities. Hours must be adapted to the convenience of the customers, which may mean being open before they go to work in the morning and after they return home at night. Very long hours of work have been the hallmark of middleman minorities around the world, whether Chinese in Southeast Asia, Lebanese in West Africa and the United States, Koreans in the United States, Indians in South Africa, or Jews, Armenians, or other middleman minorities in other countries. So has a pattern of living at very low levels of consumption and amenities, in order to survive on meager profits and save to build up the business. It has been common for middleman minorities around the world to begin by living in the backs of their stores, and in Sierra Leone, the Lebanese simply slept on the counters, which they also used to prepare their meals. In many times and places, it has been necessary to work and save for years, often in hard manual labor, just in order to accumulate enough money to be able to set up a little business, which then required additional sacrifices. A study of Korean businessmen in Atlanta showed that they worked an average of nearly 4 years, sometimes two jobs at a time, before accumulating enough money to open their first business. and that they then worked an average of more than 60 hours a week in their stores or shops. In an earlier era, Lebanese businesses in the United States were open an average of 16 to 18 hours a day. Similar hours were worked by the overseas Chinese in the Philippines, 7 days a week. In times and places where people were scattered or transportation difficult, the middleman's mobility as a peddler has been a substitute for the customer's mobility. This pattern was common among Lebanese peddlers in parts of the United States, Canada, Argentina, Brazil, the Caribbean, Australia, Senegal, the Ivory Coast, and Sierra Leone, for example. Similar patterns were common among Jewish, overseas Chinese, Indian, and other peddlers in many other countries around the world. Before these middleman minorities moved up to establish other commercial businesses, including Bloomingdale's department stores and Haker clothes. Such patterns faded over time after a more widespread availability of both public and individual transportation made the customers more mobile. Where customers have been poor, credit has been extended to them at high risk and correspondingly high interest, whether charged separately or included in the prices of goods. In peasant societies, considerable credit may have to be advanced to farmers to tide them over until harvest time, and considerable transportation, coordination, and storage may be required to collect numerous small crops and later dispense them in large shipments to urban or international markets. Because middleman minorities have typically operated with thinner profit margins per item than their indigenous counterparts, they have had to be very calculating, often with little room for error, and this characteristic may be particularly resented by others who tend to follow tradition or routine, or who seldom look far ahead or exercise much self-discipline. That is, middleman minorities may be most resented by those most dependent on them to supply the economic requirements which they themselves lack, for example, to save and supply credit for those who do not save. Economic complementarity often means social difference and political antagonism. One of the important roles played by middleman minorities is making credit available to people too poor or too unreliable to be considered good credit risks by others. Often this is possible only because the middleman minority takes the trouble to get to know many of the local people individually, and so can sort out the differing credit risks more accurately than a bank, a large corporation, or a government agency could. This pattern has been widespread from the Lebanese in West Africa to the Chinese in Thailand. Yet equally widespread is the view that middleman minorities are charging usurious or unconscionable interest rates, whether charged separately or included in the price of the products. But government agencies set up to supply credit to prevent such exploitation have often lost money, suggesting that the interest rates charged by middleman minorities were covering a very real risk. Moreover, the supposedly exploited peasants have been known to prefer dealing with the middleman minority even after government alternatives have become available. Middleman minorities around the world are often accused of taking advantage of other people's weaknesses, such as customers buying things on credit that they cannot readily afford. Accusations of this sort were as commonly made against the Jews in 18th century France as against the Chinese in Southeast Asia. Both customers and social theorists thus displace responsibility and anger onto the middleman, and often cite his exorbitant prices as the reasons for the customer's difficulties in making the payments, when in reality the likelihood of default is the reason for prices being higher than in stores, which either require payment in cash or more sweepingly exclude credit risks. The very nature of the occupation restricts the kinds of personalities who can be middlemen. There is, for example, little room for a middleman who is rowdy, drunken, or who cannot be depended on to be open for business, or to pay his suppliers or employees. Reliability is a prerequisite for the economic survival of middlemen, and has long been their hallmark, whether they were Lebanese in West Africa, Chinese in Southeast Asia, or Koreans in the United States. Moreover, insofar as middleman minorities live surrounded by people with very different values and lifestyles, many of which would be economically fatal to them, it is important to insulate their culture, and especially their children, from such influences. In a word, to be clannish. What was said of Lebanese immigrant storekeepers in the United States would apply to other middleman minorities in many other settings. School-aged children, when not in school, were at their parents' elbows, waiting on customers, making change, stocking shelves, and imbibing the shrewdness of operating an independent business on meager resources. They were inculcated with the parents' work and thrift ethics and the lesson that family unity and self-denial was essential to the family's goals. With all their attraction to America, Lebanese parents, however, disapproved of their children growing up like American children without the restraints of Lebanese values. In a later era, Korean businessmen in New York were found to be contemptuous of the extravagant lifestyles of blacks and Puerto Ricans, from whom they want to maintain a social distance. Even though Korean businesses have often been located in inner city and minority neighborhoods in various cities in the United States, the Koreans themselves have lived away from such neighborhoods, whether in New York, Atlanta, or Los Angeles. With clannishness often goes a sense of superiority, whether openly displayed or muted by politeness. This, too, may be an almost inevitable consequence of the social circumstances. It is a contradiction in terms to say that one values certain norms and yet remains indifferent to the fact that other people violate them. Moreover, differences in norms and habits are at the heart of the economic relationship between the middleman minority and the clientele they serve, whether in American cities or in the peasant communities of Burma, where Chettiars from India were the middleman minority. The main Chettiar business was to give credit to the paddy farmers. The Burmese peasant seldom had the instincts of a capitalist. When he harvested the paddy and sold his crop, he liked to have a good time, make a contribution to the pagoda, buy clothes and jewels for his wife, and then just hang on till the next harvest. Chettiar credit ensured that he could hang on. Were the Chettiars to share the values and behavior patterns of the Burmese peasant, they would, of course, be of no use to the Burmese peasant. It is precisely their differences which creates economic complementarity. Yet the political effects of these differences may be far from beneficial. Indigenous customers of the middleman minorities often resent both the attitudes and the values of the latter. Strongly held values that differ sharply between groups imply either antagonism or separation, each of which can take a variety of forms, or can be muted or concealed under a variety of polite practices or euphemisms, or else can explode into open hostility and violence. But to complain of clannishness or physical separation in this situation is to opt for the risk of open clashes. This situation is not a problem with a solution, like academic exercises. Rather, there is a question of trade-offs under serious constraints and with serious costs either way. Commercial transactions that require trust and reliability are more readily concluded among people who share not only certain traits, but whose possession of these traits can be verified more easily. An extreme example of this are the Hasidic Jews of New York's jewelry industry, who give each other consignments of precious gems to sell without the need for contracts or other costly safeguards that would be absolutely necessary if dealing with strangers. Lebanese traders in the interior of Sierra Leone likewise have had to depend on the honesty and reliability of other Lebanese traders in the port city, who sold their consignments of produce in the international market and shared the proceeds. The Chinese in Southeast Asia have also been noted for the large and complex transactions which they conduct among themselves without written contracts. In medieval times, international credit operations and credit banking were initially family enterprises among such trading groups as the Jews and the Indians, and risk pooling on long voyages originating in the Middle East was often practiced either within families or within the same ethnic group, whether among Jews, Indians, or the overseas Chinese. The considerable economic advantages of this mode of doing business, beneficial both to themselves and to their customers, who get lower prices deriving from lower business costs, are made possible by clannishness. It is a benefit with a cost, and either its acceptance or rejection involves a trade-off. The Chinese in Southeast Asia, Indians and Lebanese in Africa, and Vietnamese and Koreans in America's black ghettos are often accused of not hiring local people for responsible positions. Such complaints against middleman minorities are long-standing as well as widespread. In Uganda, for example, the Young Baganda Association in 1919 complained that Indian firms did not hire enough Baganda clerks and shop assistants. Similar complaints have been made in India's state of Assam that the Marwari businessmen there did not hire enough Assamese. In Senegal, a common complaint has been that Lebanese businessmen do not hire enough Africans. Nor are such complaints limited to different racial groups. A Nigerian writer complained of the Nigerian middleman from another region giving employment to people of his own ethnic group in preference to the employment or training of the local indigene. Despite the widespread nature of such complaints that middleman minorities seldom hire from the surrounding population or take them into business partnership, this view misses the crucial point that the very prevalence of these middleman minorities in other people's communities indicates that differences in behavior and values are involved. Otherwise, indigenous middlemen would predominate among their own people. These differences cannot simply be talked away and can be ignored only at risk to the survival of the businesses themselves. Sometimes there is an assumption that indigenous employees or partners of middleman minorities would acquire skills which would eventually enable them to function in similar roles. However, where middleman minorities have in fact hired or taken into partnership members of the local population they serve, often under political pressure, these middlemen's complaints about the locals have seldom been about a lack of skill, but rather about a set of attitudes and behavioral patterns detrimental to the business. In India's state of Assam, for example, Marwari businessmen complain that the Assamese are lazy and unreliable employees. Similar complaints have been made about local employees by Lebanese businessmen in the Ivory Coast and Korean businessmen in Atlanta. Unreliability here includes both failures to show up for work and a pattern of thefts from the business. Attitude problems have included charges made by Indian businessmen that their African partners expected to share in profits without making any contribution toward earning them. In Malaysia and Indonesia, where government policy pressures the overseas Chinese to take in indigenous partners, it is understood that only the Chinese will actually run the business and do the work, in what are popularly called Alibaba enterprises, where Ali is the local partner and Baba the overseas Chinese who does the work. Nor can all these complaints from middleman minorities be waved aside as prejudices. In Malaysia, for example, the Malay government itself has been scathing in its criticisms of the Malays for lacking initiative and enterprise. Similar criticisms have come from within other groups in countries around the world. Political leaders who pressure or threaten middleman minorities into hiring people they do not wish to hire, or even to give them responsibilities, including partnerships, that they would not have given them otherwise, may succeed in the short run in thus extracting additional benefits from those middlemen already doing business in the community, but they correspondingly reduce the attraction of locating new businesses in such communities or nations in the same way as a surtax would discourage or deter new firms from entering. Even those minority middlemen already trapped, as it were, can redirect some of their economic commitment elsewhere by 1. Canceling plans for local expansion, 2. Educating their children for different work, 3. Reinvesting their profits elsewhere, 4. Seeking opportunities to relocate themselves, or 5. Retiring earlier than otherwise. In the increasingly hostile atmosphere of post-independence Senegal, for example, young Lebanese men with professional qualifications have left the country. Malaysia's anti-Chinese policies have likewise led to an exodus of Chinese capital, as well as people. Asians in Kenya transferred large amounts of capital out of the country during its transformation from British colony to independent nation bent on Africanization. Korean storekeepers in the United States often use the profits earned in black neighborhoods where they are harassed to move on to new stores in white neighborhoods. Over the centuries, Jews have repeatedly left countries where anti-Semitic policies and mob violence had become intolerable. Indigenous political leaders, well aware of such counterproductive economic consequences of their pressures against middlemen, nevertheless have every incentive to push such policies, which reap immediate political gains, whatever their long-run economic damage to the community or the nation. Indeed, these political leaders or community activists are often among the first to denounce middleman minorities because they make their money and leave. Yet minority businessmen have often stayed for generations or even centuries before being subjected to pressures to meet politically determined goals. Hostility toward middleman minorities is often explained in terms of features peculiar to a particular group, such as the religious role assigned the Jews by some Christians, Christ killers in its crudest form. But exactly the same general pattern of hostility, occupational restriction, ghettoization, expulsions, and sporadic mass violence have marked the history of the Chinese in Southeast Asia, even though religion has not been nearly as prominent a feature of Chinese culture, and the Chinese are assigned no such demonic role in the history of other religions in Southeast Asia. Envy and hostility that have been expressed in religious terms in Europe have simply been expressed primarily in secular terms in Asia. While some Southeast Asian Muslims denounce the overseas Chinese as infidels whose love of pork and gambling are offensive, these objections are hardly crucial, for non-Muslims in the region exhibit similar hostility toward the Chinese. Among the many changes leveled at middleman minorities by their critics is that they are sojourners whose loyalties are to another nation, and that they drain away the resources of the host country to enrich their respective homelands. Indeed, sojourning has even been alleged to be a necessary part of the very definition of middleman minorities. But the Jews, the classic middleman minority to whom others are analogized, had for many centuries no homeland to which they could return. To say that they had an emotional attachment to an ancestral homeland is to say no more than could be said of Irish Americans, Germans in Russia, or Japanese in Brazil, none of whom have been regarded as sojourners or as middleman minorities. The Chinese in Southeast Asia were in fact for many years sojourners, but not predominantly so since the 1930s, and especially not so since the communists took control of China in 1949. Far from exhibiting the former pattern of an overwhelmingly male immigrant population characteristic of sojourners, the overseas Chinese in general became sex-balanced, family-based communities with local roots in countries around the world. The Jews have lived in that pattern for centuries. So have the Parsis in India, and so did the Armenians in the Ottoman Empire. Moreover, the ending of the sojourner pattern among the overseas Chinese, and a correspondingly drastic reduction of remittances to China, did not reduce the hostility to them or the discrimination against them in Southeast Asia. Similarly, anti-Semitism has been virulent in countries where the Jews were a stable, settled community for centuries. Genocidal levels of violence have been unleashed not only against the Jews, but also against such other non-sojourning groups as the Armenians in Turkey and the Igbos of Nigeria, the attacks against those groups exceeding even the mass violence unleashed sporadically against the sojourning Chinese. It is often claimed, not only by politicians but by scholars as well, that middleman minorities monopolize certain occupations or industries. The fact that middleman minorities organize their own professional and business associations is hardly decisive evidence of this, because 1, both successful and unsuccessful groups do the same, and 2, middleman minorities were also organized in industries where they lost out in competition to others, as the Chinese were displaced by Europeans in highly capitalized industries in Southeast Asia, just as they were organized in industries where they prevailed. Loose use of words like monopolize confuses exclusion of others with outperforming them. Far from being able to exclude business competitors, middleman minorities have often found indigenous businessmen already well established in countries to which they immigrated, and only by offering lower prices, credit, longer hours, and the like, have middleman minorities replaced them in the economy. Even after having done so, middleman minorities represent no economically meaningful monopoly, since they tend to be concentrated in highly competitive industries, whatever the racial composition of the competitors. Characteristics that derive from the differentness or hostility of the surrounding population have often been included among the essential characteristics of middleman minorities. For example, living in separate enclaves, clinging to an alien language and culture, maintaining separate organizations, and a general social exclusiveness, especially as regards marriage. But these patterns have been equally characteristic of German farmers in Russia and Latin America, Russians living in Central Asia, and Japanese farmers in Brazil, not to mention the British of the colonial era in countries around the world. Where middleman minorities have been accepted by the host society, they have tended to assimilate both culturally and biologically. The Jews of pre-Nazi Germany were a classic example, so are the Chinese in the United States, as contrasted with the Chinese in Malaysia. Some have tried to depict the cultural characteristics of middleman minorities as primarily a function of the constraints imposed upon them by the host societies in which they live, and only secondarily of the group's own cultural development. In short, their economic activity has, in this view, been more the consequence of what they were allowed to do than of any traditional proclivity of their own. By arbitrarily restricting the range of examples to colonial societies, one can lend some credence to the idea that middleman minorities were let in on sufferance to fulfill a specific purpose. However, even in colonial societies, middleman minorities were often present and sometimes economically dominant in some occupations before the colonial power arrived on the scene. This was certainly true of the Indians in Zanzibar or the Jews in parts of Poland annexed by Tsarist Russia. In other areas taken over by imperialist powers, middleman minorities were, of course, not exempt from the general heavy-handed economic control exercised by some colonial governments. But this is not to say that their concentration in retailing, moneylending, and other traditional middleman occupations was primarily a result of choices made by colonial officials, especially since these occupations were traditional among such groups in non-colonial societies as well. Often the colonial regime simply codified and rigidified existing economic patterns, or tried to manipulate them for the benefit of its home country or local members of the imperial race. Moreover, similar occupational patterns have been common in countries which were not colonies, and where no official policy existed on the occupations of individuals or groups. In countries such as Australia, the United States, or Argentina, for example, no one chose the occupations of Jews other than the Jews themselves. Once past Ellis Island, a Jewish immigrant to America was free to go wherever he chose, geographically, occupationally, or otherwise, and usually chose to locate in major metropolitan areas and in the same kinds of industries and occupations as Jews in Argentina or Australia. Meanwhile, the Irish in all three countries chose entirely different paths. The claim that denial of access to land forced middleman minorities into urban occupations is not without historical examples, but that claim can also be pushed too far, especially as applied to recent history. Wealthy Jewish philanthropist Baron de Hirsch bought up large areas of land for Jews in a number of countries, in a vain attempt to change their urban concentration patterns. Yet often the Jews who settled on this land drifted back to urban occupations within a generation. Attempts have been made to use the Indian farmers in Fiji, Guyana, and South Africa as evidence that the availability of land in these countries led them to an agricultural occupational pattern quite different from that of Indians who settled elsewhere and became middleman minorities. But this ignores the crucial fact that Indians from an agricultural background in India were deliberately selected and transported to these places and to Sri Lanka and Malaya during the colonial era, while Gujaratis, Chettiars, and other middleman groups from India settled in East Africa, Burma, and elsewhere. Indeed, such groups as the Gujaratis continued to follow middleman occupations in Fiji, South Africa, and other countries where most Indians were farmers or farm laborers. It was precisely the traditional proclivity which reappeared in distant societies, despite the arbitrary dismissal of that possibility by intellectuals. Whatever the race or culture of middlemen, they have aroused suspicions, resentments, and misunderstandings in the most disparate societies around the world. Even where they were not a distinct minority at all, the very functions they performed have been misunderstood and the people performing them condemned. Selling the same product for more than it cost the seller has been seen as morally objectionable, and requiring more money to be repaid than was lent originally has been condemned in both secular and religious laws. Merchants were held in low esteem in Confucian China, and usury was outlawed in both the Christian societies of medieval Europe and the Muslim societies of North Africa and the Middle East. A common complaint among the colonial officials of West Africa during the imperialist era was that there was excessive petty trading going on among the Africans, who would be more productive if transferred into either industry or agriculture. Yet a noted economist who studied the economy of the region found that these African petty traders performed essential and valuable services, which he analyzed in detail, and concluded, if the traders were superfluous and their services unnecessary, the customers would bypass them to save the price of their services, that is, the profit margin of the intermediaries. Many of these supposedly redundant African petty traders camped outside European-owned stores, so the alternative of eliminating the middleman was readily at hand, had the African consumers chosen to buy in the standard quantities sold by European merchants, rather than purchase in the smaller quantities offered by African traders, who would sell a single drop of perfume, half a cigarette, or a small bundle of 10 matches. In the very different setting of a prisoner of war camp during World War II, very similar misconceptions arose regarding the role of middlemen. Some Allied prisoners of war circulated among their fellow POWs, exchanging various items from the standard Red Cross packages which they all received monthly. and trading also for items of personal belongings that some wished to swap for other things. In addition, these middlemen would lend cigarettes or chocolates from Red Cross packages near the end of the months to those who had already used up their own, charging interest by requiring a repayment of more cigarettes or chocolates from the next month's Red Cross packages. Here, too, the middlemen were not racially distinct from their customers, and their flourishing business indicated to an economist among them that they were performing a valuable service. But that was not how public opinion in the POW camp saw them. Taken as a whole, public opinion was hostile to the middleman. His function and his hard work in bringing buyer and seller together were ignored. Profits were not regarded as a reward for labor, but as the result of sharp practices. Despite the fact that his very existence was proof to the contrary, the middleman was held to be redundant. In short, misunderstandings of the middleman function occur in the most disparate settings, among the most disparate peoples, and have led to moral condemnations, legal prohibitions, and violence, ranging from lethal mob riots to genocide. It is virtually impossible to explain this worldwide pattern, which goes back thousands of years, by the special characteristics of a particular middleman minority or a particular society in which they happen to be, though no doubt local variations add special features or special rhetoric. But both the middleman minorities themselves and those opposed to them have responded to the constraints inherent in the circumstances, whether economic and social constraints in the case of the middlemen, or the constraints of human understanding, by those observers who misconceive the nature of the economic function being performed. A third element that has often proved to be decisive and disastrous has been the talented demagogue, whether local or national, who knows how to exploit the situation for his own ends. One of the curious features of middleman minorities has been their affinity for the political left, despite being themselves almost textbook capitalists. Jews in Europe, the United States, Chile, Israel, Cuba, and South Africa have historically been prominent on the political left, whether moderate or extreme. American Jews have a long history of supporting very liberal candidates of both major political parties, and regardless of whether the candidate or his opponent was Jewish or not. Many Jewish university students in Brazil have been so politically radical and anti-Zionist that they have cut their ties with their parents and the Jewish community. Despite various attempts to explain this affinity for the political left in terms of Jewish traditions or Jewish history, this pattern is not confined to Jews, but has been common among other middleman minorities around the world. In post-war Malaysia, for example, the communist guerrillas who plunged that country into civil war were almost all overseas Chinese. The overseas Indians have likewise been identified with the political left in various countries. Urban Indian voters in Malaysia supported left-wing parties. In Fiji, the short-lived Indian-dominated government which provoked the military coup of 1987 was a left-wing government, bent on nationalization and income redistribution. The Indian vote in the first elections held in Ceylon supported a number of Marxist candidates. In South Africa, during the era of white minority rule, Indians were characterized as more communistic than the blacks. Similarly, the best-known Indian politician in the Western Hemisphere has been Dr. Chetty Jagan of Guyana, a Marxist with substantial political support from within his own East Indian community. Why middleman minorities, of all people, should be supporters of the political left is a large, unanswered question. Part of the answer may be that such groups often evolve toward non-entrepreneurial careers and lifestyles in the wake of entrepreneurial success. Children of prosperous businessmen often enter a university atmosphere that is politically left of center in countries around the world. Moreover, the prosperity which represents hard-won achievement by the older generation is, to the younger generation, merely a windfall gain and therefore a potential source of guilt. In addition, the remarkable achievements of the older generation of middleman minorities make them a tough act to follow in the same field, while political leftism offers the younger generation instant moral superiority. It may also be that middleman minorities, as groups with histories of being persecuted, cannot identify with conservative establishments or are not fully accepted by them, despite having reached high economic levels. The differing political orientations of the Middle Eastern Jews and the westernized Jews in Israel lend support to the notion that it is the evolution of middleman minorities toward non-entrepreneurial roles which marks their susceptibility to the doctrines of the political left. Middle Eastern Jews, who largely remained middlemen in the Arab world before entering Israel, have generally supported the more conservative parties, while the Ashkenazic Jews of Europe and the Western Hemisphere, who were more likely to be intellectuals and professionals, have long supported socialism and the welfare state. Whatever the combinations of reasons, the tendency of middleman minorities to favor the political left is a striking phenomenon worthy of further research and analysis. Encapsulated minorities. The Germans, who lived in separate enclaves in Tsarist Russia for about a century, and then moved to the Western Hemisphere, represent an unusual and revealing social phenomenon. Cut off from their original culture for generations, and yet virtually unaffected by the culture around them, they preserved a way of life that had changed in Germany itself, so much so that they appeared strange to other Germans who they encountered in passing through Germany, or after reaching the United States or Brazil. The Volga Germans and Black Sea Germans had been isolated in both time and space, encapsulated, as it were, in the 18th century, while the rest of the world moved on. Over time, some Russian words might infiltrate the German language they spoke, but nevertheless, it was still German being spoken on into the 20th century. Even more striking examples of being encapsulated were those German religious sects whose withdrawal from the world and its progress was very deliberate, the Amish and the Mennonites, for example, whose language, dress, and farming techniques remained in the 18th century in many ways. Neither the Germans in Russia nor the Amish and the Mennonites in the United States remained literally 100% unchanged, but what is remarkable is how few were their concessions and adaptations to a world which changed radically around them over a period of two centuries. Jews in the Islamic countries of North Africa and the Middle East showed a similar pattern, though not so much by choice as by centuries of isolation among Muslims. While their contacts with the Western world grew tenuous, the historic reversal of the relative positions of Sephardic and Ashkenazic Jews, painfully apparent later in Israel, reflected the encapsulation of many Sephardics in an Islamic world which had not matched the dynamism of European civilization in recent centuries. Where the Sephardic Jews were not encapsulated, as in the United States or in Curaçao, no such dramatic reversal of position took place, even though Ashkenazic Jews advanced rapidly in these places. Moreover, within Ashkenazic Jewry, the historic differences between German and Eastern European Jews reflected the encapsulation of the latter among the Poles and Russians. Once this isolation was ended, after the massive migrations from Eastern Europe to the United States, the gap began to close. There are varying degrees of encapsulation, as with most social phenomena. Overseas Indians have tended to live in relative isolation from surrounding cultures and cut off from the culture of India as it has developed since they or their ancestors left the subcontinent. Yet their degree of isolation from the host culture, the stability of the original culture, and their isolation from cultural changes in India have not been as great in most countries as with the Volga Germans of the 19th century, for example. Travel back and forth to India has maintained contact with the homeland for Indian communities in Asia and Africa, and modern communications, including movies, have supplemented this, especially for overseas Indians in the more distant Western Hemisphere. Encapsulated groups are more than a social or historical curiosity. They represent one test of the effects of genetic and environmental factors. The historic reversal of the relative cultural and economic positions of the Sephardic and Ashkenazic Jews, for example, undermines any argument that either was genetically superior to the other, even though differences in physical appearance indicate that they are indeed genetically different. Economic and social gaps that opened between Reich Germans and Russian Germans in 19th century Europe and narrowed in 20th century America likewise illustrate the effects of large environmental differences.